Welcome to Witchlit, a place to talk about the craft of writing and writing the craft. I'm your host, Victoria Rashke, author, publisher, witch, and nosy Scorpio. Witchlit is brought to you by Thousand Bolt Press, a family-owned independent publisher established to produce the books we want to see in the world. Titles including Changing Paths by Yvonne Abreu, Conjuring the Commonplace by Lane Fuller and Corey Thomas Hutchison, and my latest book, Verona Green, can be purchased directly from thousandvoltpress.com or wherever you buy books.
Kevin Keles earned his Master's of Divinity degree in 1995 and his Master's of Arts degree in Community Counseling in 2011. He served in hospice for 15 years and has been a licensed professional counselor for almost a decade. Kevin is the author of Spiritual Care to the Elderly and Dying Loved Ones, Last Breath Awareness, and has written over a dozen articles. He is the founder of Conversing with Death and currently lives in Georgia with his wife, two children, and a favorite four-legged friend. His latest book is Bring Your Pen, Bring Your Broom, Conversations Between Therapist and Witch. Kevin Keles, welcome to Witchlit.
Well, thank you, Victoria. Did I give you all that to say?
I got it out of your book.
Oh, okay. I got you. I don't remember because I've gone to some places and whether it's lecture or whatever, and they asked me for something to introduce me with. And I don't know sometimes if I give it to them or whether they read it, but you read it off the book.
I got another book. So our first question for everyone on the show, I'm excited to talk about the book, but I always ask this first. And I think this is interesting for you because you've got a lot going on. Okay. So you're a therapist, you run an organization, you do all this stuff. So why write? Why still write books?
I think that's, to me, when I first started writing, and Spiritual Care to Elderly and Dying Loved Ones was my first book. And when I did that, all those years in high school where I didn't pay attention to the English teacher, I said all of that really came to haunt me because I was terrible at writing. And it took like one, maybe two editors to help me with it all. But it's interesting now. That book is over a decade old and still is a good classical book for people and professionals who work with end of life. But when I ended up writing more and more, that to me is one of the most therapeutic expressions that I can find. I'm not a good artist as much as I love art. Like I can go and just really get into people's art, but I don't really do a lot of drawing or anything like that. Mm-hmm. But writing to me is pretty powerful and cathartic at times. And so to me, and when I write, I can write pretty fast now. And as I write, I have this like creative, really like this creative juice that goes when I hit a particular topic and it really matters to me. Like I did with Bring Your Pen, Bring Your Broom. I got that book done in about a month and a half. Mm-hmm. To me, it was just, and it was almost as if I was not alone with it. Now that's just, you know, that probably can be explained in other ways, but it felt like, wow, this info is really moving and really mm-hmm. flowing. And I felt so satisfied. And that's the outcome of a lot of my writing. Mm-hmm. There's a sense of satisfaction, you know, sort of like not just leaving your imprint, but just leaving something that has meaning to me and conveying it to someone else.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, I think that makes sense, especially with your work and having read the book. I mean, you're kind of in a niche in your field, really, it sounds like. So what was the impetus particularly for this book that we're talking about? Do you want to give people kind of a little synopsis if they haven't read it?
Yeah. So Bring Your Pen, Bring Your Broom. I am a psychotherapist. I've been a psychotherapist for 10 years in Georgia. And I have a long history of just this sort of, I don't know what to call it. There were times it was religious because I could just move into institutionalized type stuff and then I didn't like it. But when I could flow nice, there was just these movements spiritually, mystically, esoterically. And so there's always been this combination of stuff moving within me. And when I started my profession, first in hospice, I started out in chaplaincy, which a lot of people don't realize that to be a full-time chaplain, you really got to undergo a lot of like deep work. It's different mm-hmm. than volunteer counsel, volunteer chaplain, all that stuff. So I did like 2.5 years, one in a, at the time they used to have residencies for patients with psychiatric issues. And then about 1.5 years, I think I did at a major hospital. But, you know, that was a beautiful time for me to combine psyche and spirit, however I define spirit. And so as, I mean, kind of jumping from there back there, all these movements going on, meditation became a big thing. And I traveled to India twice by myself, which was very, very, a very powerful experience. And sort of I now join companies with people like Madame Blavatsky and Aleister Crowley. And I'm like, all of these folks went there. And I went to first Varanasi, where I did like a 10-day meditation. And that was pretty cool. Then I went to Rishikesh, where I certified as a yoga teacher. But, oh, it was powerful. I mean, when I came back, the movement within was so strong. I would weep at times. I didn't know why I was weeping. I was just being moved by that Mother India. So bent back to work and did my stuff as psychotherapist and all that. And then this book comes along. And so I was, on the one hand, celebrating this, what I thought, real nice integration between psychotherapy and the esoterics, or the witchy, however we want to call it, the mystical. And then it was, okay, now I want to be informative, because not a lot of people are doing this. Not a lot of people can do this. In fact, part of the book involves bridging the two sides together, because in general, and I know that there are exceptions, but in general, psychotherapy does not look towards the witch in a very nice way. It doesn't look to the esoteric and a lot of things that we're talking about, because, you know, I have interest in other unusual phenomena like the paranormal and UFO. But then on the other hand, I always struggled and wondered about, you know, where is the witch? Why doesn't she come to psychotherapy? And I mean, the answer could be numerous, right? We don't know. But I would sometimes pick up on, when I would be with others of like-minded faith, I would sometimes pick up these sort of comments that almost sounded either as if we don't need them or we don't like them. Mm-hmm. You know, there's this gap in between the two of them. And I thought to myself, actually, the psychotherapist can learn a lot from the witch, and the witch can learn a lot from the psychotherapist, given that you find the right one, because I get that. Mm-hmm. And so that's what made me bring the book together. And then once I had the two in the same room, so to speak, I ended up really bringing out the things that I think I often hear, the struggles, you know, which was, you know, how do we deal with depression and anxiety and trauma? And I've moved away from using that terminology, because I just, it's not empowering. But for now, and for time's sake, I usually use them just to bring them in. But it was like, I know that whether you are, you know, whatever esoteric style you have, whatever the witch does, I know that we all struggle with depression at one time or another. That doesn't mean we need a diagnosis, but we all struggle with depression and anxiety. We all know what it's like to have hard times in life. And sometimes these, doing therapy, not in the name of I'm broken and need fixing, but more in the sense of how can I invest for a time and rediscover and re-empower myself, and then move back into that place of doing your art or your practice in a way that is, you know, that flows freely, you know? And so out of all of that, I said, let me put that down on the book. And away I went.
Nice. Yeah, I mean, I do think it can be a challenge, and you bring this up in the book, that, you know, people who have
I guess in the magical community, get accused of magical thinking, right? I mean, it's it's difficult to kind of separate those, I think, if you don't share that worldview. So I think that's what a lot of people butt up against. And I know, just having looked for therapy in the South previously after, you know, like a big life event, I was referred to a Christian counselor and I was like, oh, this is not going to work.
Oh, wow.
It was immediate. Like, this is not going to work because I'm going to get called out. And and I was like, I this is not comfortable. So, I can see how that would be something. I mean, from my personal experience. Yes, it's real.
Well, I think that's an excellent and unfortunate example, but it's real. Now, I spend, you know, I spend a good time holding the magical community accountable. And that is, I worked quite a bit, whether it was with psychosis, delusions. I've worked with people who have struggled with stuff like that. And so I have an eye for that. And in my book, I try to sort of bring in this balance of saying, look, celebrate your work, celebrate your practice, but hold it at times just at arm's length in order to just look at it carefully and make sure that you're not falling into something that might be concerning, because those things happen. Mm-hmm. Now, on the other hand, I would also argue against my fellow therapists about, be careful not to use your bias or your prejudices against the witch, against the magical community, and just quickly call anything that she does delusional, narcissistic, all these wonderful terms, and even psychotic.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's important. This is why, again, I bridge the two together, hoping that I'll have an ear from both sides, because both have their strengths, but both have their limitations, especially when they meet with one another.
Mm-hmm. Have you gotten feedback from the therapy community on the book at all? I mean, I you had this beautiful foreword. I mean, the foreword is fantastic.
Yeah.
But,
yeah. Deborah Katz was so fantastic about that. She, I mean, she was so ready to put a forward in. I was so honored. I get a lot of the feedback that I get from the therapeutic community is from the people who are also witchy, you know, also esoteric and mystical. And they appreciate that. And they're like, man, there's not enough of this to go around.
Mm-hmm.
But depending on where you're at, because, you know, in some places you could be more open and there's more of that openness even within the professional field. Some places that sort of holding back and sort of like demonizing the whole practice. They know very little. And sometimes I'm surprised, because we as psychotherapists have to work our stuff, right? We have to do our own therapy. We need supervision. We need all that stuff to ensure that we're not working out of some bias. But when it comes to working with either experiencers who have had UFO experiences, near-death experiences, or the esoteric or the mystical, whatever it is, something happens. And it's as if they forget, whoa, I could literally use my field to pathologize a normal person.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I was thinking too, reading the book, you talk about being out as a therapist and why a lot of people in counseling or therapy would be reluctant to do that for professional reasons. And I was thinking about how that kind of extrapolates for a lot of people who, you know, may not be out because of concerns with their family or, and I was thinking about how that's its own pressure in the magical or witchcraft community to be closeted or to be careful about who knows who you really are, and thinking about, like, that's kind of its own, I guess, problem or issue that people might seek therapy over. And I just wondered if you could maybe talk about that.
I think that's an excellent point. My understanding of, you know, of I don't even want to use the word diagnosis or anything like that, but a lot of our struggles is really that it involves our lifestyle, where we live, economical pressures. I mean, these are the things that create things like depression and anxiety and all that stuff. And there is something that doesn't feel empowering or something you can integrate when you have to hide. I mean, we all know what it's like to hide for one reason or another. It's something we do, who we are. But when you feel you have to sort of hide that part of you, this is why I wanted to be an example. It was tough for me. I put it in the book to sort of come out because I was afraid of what my colleagues would say. I was afraid of how people would treat me. Not my family, not my little ones. They're pretty cool. You know, they all know who daddy is. But even in the community, there was this struggle. And I said, I've got to be an example. I've got a taste of the struggles. And I've got to be courageous. And now, as I think I mentioned in my book, I'm almost 61. I don't have a lot of time to waste to try to be open and courageous. I want to get it done. And so there's something freeing about that. But I don't know if it's always like once you get there, it's all downhill from there because you do face things. And some people, not me, some people have faced some very tough times as a result of saying, you know, I'm magical or I'm esoteric or I'm a witch. Or, and we know from history what that looks like, mm-hmm. where people, moms, grandparents, children, wives were burned. They were killed. And so the connotation of the word witch, as much as it is, has its beauty, it's also very potent mm-hmm. and can be taken in such a negative way to the point that if a community has a dominant religion and a dominant set of politics that coincide, which it did in the past, that's danger. Nobody can fight with that. And people lost their lives in the name of either being thought they were a mm-hmm. witch or they were and they were happy with it. They weren't doing any harm. They were happy with it. But nevertheless, God. Mm-hmm. God's will, you know, was for us to clean house and they would hurt people. Now, today, it does happen in other parts of the world, from what I understand. Mm-hmm. But someplace like here, you could lose your job, you can lose your license, you can lose a lot of things. So it makes sense to me why some people would hesitate. And so what I say to them is, I get it that there's maybe that part of you that wants to just, you know how you see these football teams, they break through some flag or something when they're coming into the field. I get that. But we have to be wise as serpents. And there is a place for doing it carefully and mm-hmm. slowly. There's a time to talk to people like you and me. We can talk about this freely. There's a time to be quiet. And that's just, I think you can say that with a lot of things. Sometimes when we want to just burst out and just tell the world, we can look awkward. You know, mm-hmm. it's almost like talking to the grocery attendant about something that's witchy or something. And it's like, we almost feel out of place. Like, that's not quite the guy that I'm looking for, you know? Yeah. Yeah. So we want to be careful. We want to be wise, but we also want to work towards opening up, because you're right, that could be a downer to try to hide all the time from people.
Yeah, I mean, I obviously doesn't just apply to, you know, magic or witchcraft, right. But yeah, I think about that a lot, and I think, you know, I mean, obviously, writing books that include witchcraft and having a podcast, I kind of outed myself, and yeah, I mean, I was never. I never lied about it, but I was never open about it.
Right.
And then now it's like, yeah, I mean, if you Google me, I have a podcast about witchcraft, so it's kind of hard not to know. And I know I've wondered if like moving from Tennessee to California had something to do with being more willing to be open about that. And I can't say that that wasn't part of it, but, it's an interesting thing to me. And I feel like what you said about being an example, because I feel like for those of us who are in a position where I'm not going to lose my job, I'm self-employed, you know, there's just a lot of, you know, a lot of things in my life that make it situationally okay for me to be out. I feel like, I don't know that I feel like I have a duty to do that, but I feel like it's helpful that if I can do that for other people who may struggle.
Perfect. Right. So. Well said. I think being an example, I think is important. And a good example, you know, you're right. I think certain places that we live in make it easier and make it harder. You know, some of our families, I mean, I know of folks who are in a Christian setting and they can't, or they're just tolerated. It does impact the dynamics of how people, families, friends relate to one another. Mm-hmm. So I think, you know, it's important to work towards that end of open, you know, because I think there's something precious about being open, being free. Mm-hmm. But then there's also, we live in a world that doesn't sometimes have its stuff together. And whether it's in the name of God, in the name of politics or whatever, people find it justifiable to do another human being harm for a name.
Well, and I think, and you also bring this up in your book about, you know, a lot of witches come from, you know, what I would consider like mainline religions, I guess, especially Christianity in the United States. And, you know, a lot of us still have relationships with those spiritual teachers or saints or, you know, like, so, you know, witches aren't completely devoid of understanding the overculture because we're part of it too.
Right. Yeah. You know, I, as I developed my own sort of art and practice, I'm one that sort of gravitates sort of a soul practitioner, sort of, there's so much out there that is so yummy. You know, when it comes to magic, when it comes to spirituality, mysticism, all that stuff. And when I look back, I can say to you, I never do well if I try to fit into something. That happened with religion, i.e. evangelical Christianity. It happened in the military. It's just like, I don't gravitate. I gravitate to it. Weird, like what is my unconscious doing to me? And then I have some satisfaction, I grow restless and I don't like it. I do better on my own, but when I do, it's not like I'm just going to a store and picking out stuff. This is what I want, this is what I don't want. It takes a lot of hard work. It took me quite a few years to develop what I now consider my own spiritual magical practice. And as you know, there's no manual for that. So a lot of it I had to do on my own. I didn't want to talk to people about it. And there were times I scared the out of myself and times that I was okay and celebrated.
Yeah.
But it takes a lot of hard work. But I wanted to capture so much. There were so many things that I felt honorable. It's like, I wanted to capture my ancestors, for example, the Taino Indians, you know, and when I say I wanted to capture, I wanted to know a little bit about their ways, how they understood the world, and I also wanted to understand their suffering. I feel as a person that I sort of have some sort of a hold on the oppression that they faced. And what that was like. Because I seem to always try to defend the underdog and try to sort of, that's sort of the same thing with the book. I go to try to defend those who have been oppressed. Now, people can understand that differently. They might be like, okay, you like to help people who can't help themselves or whatever. Mm-hmm. Okay, if you want to interpret it that way, but I do feel that I honor my ancestors by never forgetting about their suffering. Mm-hmm. And so as I was developing all this, I said, I want to develop the beauty that I come from, the beauty of my history. And at the same time, I wanted to honor the beauty that's out there by other great minds. And so rather eclectic in some ways, but I came up with a spirituality that I felt was very meaningful to me. One that is not just of the head, right? Do this, face east, north, south, west, whatever. But something that had energetic and spiritual meaning. Almost as if, Victoria, if I was to not be able to run around a fire, if I was not able to even talk, how can I carry out my practice in a way that feels empowering? Mm-hmm. And so that was the gist of bringing it all together and creating what feels to me home.
I like that. And it's funny, I was reading last night, as I read a lot for the podcast, and I was reading the book for the next interview, and Ivo Dominguez Jr. it was co-written with him. And he talks about in the opening chapters of the book about it's very easy in our culture, especially in our subculture, to choose a label for yourself. Yeah. Like, I'm a kitchen witch, or I'm a, you know, whatever.
Yeah.
And that mm-hmm. then you then limit yourself by doing that when there's this, indeed. like you said, there's just this buffet of things you can be into in the magical community. And mm-hmm. it's fascinating to me, like, how, and I think that's one of the things that drew me to it. It's not just the eclecticism, it's the, like personalization within a collective, I guess. Like, you're part of this.
I love that.
Community.
That's better. Mm-hmm.
But you like pull these things to yourself from that.
Yes.
Culture. So.
Yeah, I like that. I don't like the word eclectic. I need to find something. There's so many words I don't like, but that one I don't like for sure. But that's so true, and I love what you said about how that there is something that I sort of step away from. And I think you nailed it. When we label ourselves the kitchen witch, you know, the green witch, and then we do that, even like whether we pick Hecate or we pick whoever it is, we begin to label us, and we fall into the same problem that I think religion has in many, many ways. There is something courageous and powerful about not knowing and not having that sort of structure or boundary and allowing spirit just to be. Mm-hmm. There's something quite powerful. This is what draws me to mysticism, and that is they are comfortable in the not knowing.
Yeah.
They are comfortable in not putting it all together. They are comfortable with the fear that comes with all of that. To me, I get it about structure. I get it about sort of wanting to identify. But when we identify with a label, we're not identifying with our deep soul. We're identifying with something that already exists. And we've made that mistake before. I'll label myself. This is who I am. I associate with this group or this person or this color or this theme. And the next thing you know is we're not satisfied. That we haven't found ourselves. And what I love about the magical community as a whole is that you can find the dark and the light, which is exactly what we are, the dark and the light. Mm-hmm. And when you go to the light, there is all sorts of stuff that happens. And when you go to the dark, there's all sorts of stuff that happens.
Yeah.
But if you can move in and out in ways where you prevent yourself from labeling, or saying, I've discovered the way that you and everybody should practice. Oh, I just, that's not the way to
walk away slowly.
Oh my, indeed. Indeed.
Yeah. Yeah. I you bring up the light and the dark. And again, another thing about your book I enjoyed was the section about witches and cemeteries and how, like, if you tell your therapist that you like to hang out in therapy, they might think, if you like to hang out in cemeteries, they might think you're a little morbid.
Yeah.
But I loved that you cross-referenced that with, like, the Buddhist idea of meditating in a cemetery to meditate on your mortality. And yes. That, you know, to me, at least, you know, in my 51 years, that it's like, it's so much easier to live if you've accepted that you're going to die. Like, just to have that, you know, I guess memento mori to some extent, but that this is a temporary experience, and that seems important. And I guess I'm always a little still surprised myself when I think about people who are just like, I don't want to talk about it, I don't want to think about it, it doesn't exist. Mm-hmm. Which, I mean, we've kind of done as a culture in the United States. We put death as behind many walls as we possibly can.
As far away as possible, mm-hmm. as far away as possible. And, you know, a lot of that of my work with death and dying comes from 15 years of working in hospice. You know, when I started and I worked and I would sit in the rooms and I would watch people, you know, struggle to breathe, deal with their illnesses, you know, struggle with this whole thing of pain and even smell death, right? It changed me. I lost a daughter very early in life, my first child. So that changed me. Before that, I thought, I'm Mr. Smarty. I'm going to change this world. I've got mm-hmm. it all together. And then after that happened, life humbled me. But as I walked into hospice and I saw, my God, how fast and how brief this life is. Why don't we talk about this stuff? Other countries, other cultures do. We got mm-hmm. El Día de los Muertos, where you have people who, you know, the culture that celebrates around those who have passed and communicate with them. They do also, there are ways to do so. But in our culture, we want to believe that everything we have in our system, the hospitals, science, that all these things are going to help us to live 100+ years, and still mm-hmm. that hasn't happened. I mean, very few, right? And yeah. I come from a place where my parents are almost mm-hmm. 90, and my abuela, my grandmother, I remember her walking around and rolling her tobacco, and she lived into her late 90s, you know? Mm-hmm. But the average lifespan is no more than, what, 77, 79. It dropped after the pandemic.
Yeah.
It's important to think about these things. Now, my wife and I, she's a social worker, worked in a nursing facility for 21 years. I worked in hospice for 15. So you can imagine what life was like and is like here. My kids are they hear this kind of stuff. In fact, I wrote this in Last Breath Awareness. My daughter at 7 years of age, I was taking her to some sort of summer camp or something. It was, you know, one of those things they get into. And we would always pass this Methodist church that had a little cemetery plot there. And so one day my daughter said, I want to go there. Now, I could have done what culture tells me to do. Oh, honey, that's not the place. Let's go to Disney or that, you know, let's not yeah. think about that. We went there and I got to explain to her why names look the same, why the last names are sometimes the same, the different types of plots, the numbers. I mm-hmm. got to tell her all that. That was very, very informative. And she is now 17 and pretty bright, and she has a voice. She has her own voice. And but I thought to myself, why do we hide this thing about illness and dying from even children? Mm-hmm. It's our culture that says don't do it. Yeah. It's not everybody. And so out of all of that, I thought it's very important for the witch to know too. As much as we sometimes go to cemeteries, we don't often contemplate, how am I going to die? Mm-hmm. Like, what is my process going to be like? We pretty much have the top 10 ways of how people die in the U.S., so we're more than likely going to fit one of them. But being able, not just informative, sort of like what the Buddhists do, where, and I know Buddhists, when I say that, they're very different. They're a lot of different right. sects. But there's a sense of being able to gain a felt sense of my impermanence. It's one thing for us, you and me, to say, we say, yeah, I know I'm going to die. And then say, let's go out to eat. Like it's so casual. No, I have trained fellow therapists for years in this, and I have even seen them become very sober and quiet. We, many of us, if not most of us, are not trained, including the witch, are not trained to truly reflect. I'm going to get old. I'm going to become ill. And I'm going to die of something. And so at the end of the book, towards the end, I call it the witch's wheelchair. Because we who are in the practice will one day not be able to walk around and jump and fly or whatever it is. We'll have to do some of that in a wheelchair. We'll have to do that while we're laying in a semi-private room. We won't have what we used to have. And that's why I say, I introduce this idea of when that starts to happen, pray first that our minds are still intact, but if they are, to be able to work out of that inner altar to where you create your circle from within, to where you create your fire from within, to where you communicate from within, because we are going to get limited. Our bodies are going to do funny things. And illnesses are going to happen.
Yeah. And I think it's important to think about, I mean, I've had so many interesting people in the show. And one of the people I had on really early was Penny Billington, who's a druid in the UK and is an elder in druidry, and was talking about, you know, their practice is so oriented to going out to be in a grove of trees, to be in the forest. And as you age, that gets harder and harder. And so in this beautiful book she wrote about trees, she talks about how to bring that to people who can't go to that place, like how to have that experience when you aren't physically able to do that. Beautiful. And I just thought it was really beautiful. And
yeah.
And I was thinking also, the woman who wrote Paganism for Prisoners, the same situation. Mm-hmm. Like, they're not allowed in that setting to have the trappings that we have associated with doing witchcraft or ritual.
Very good point. Again,
that inner altar becomes really important.
Yeah. And you see, the reason why I like to sort of push, whether it's the witch or whether whoever, why I like to push them into thinking about their own impermanence is because, especially as therapists, right? We're always like, we want to help the client go deeper and deeper. Well, they will only go as far as we go. And if I put on the brakes to explore my own existential angst, how am I going to help a client go deep? Mm-hmm. I can't. And it's the same with the whole idea of the witch's wheelchair. It's like, why I want to nudge the witch to think about it is because I've seen more than I'd like of people breaking down the subject and actually inhibiting the conversation. I've seen people who will give you that hint. Oh, I don't know if I have a lot of time left. And what I see in response is more like, oh, honey, you have all the time in the world. Don't worry, the 50s, the new 30 or something like that. All this stuff. And I'm like, that is such nonsense. The truth be told, when I wrote that chapter of the witch's wheelchair was because I had our elderly in mind. I had the men and women who are now old, but who were catalysts in some form of fashion with the practice and can't do it no more. And unless the younger of the tribe can be brave enough to understand impermanence in their own lives, they'll be able to walk into that nursing home where one of our elders are and be able to bring something to them, as opposed to staying away from the nursing home or not talking about, you know, what's going to happen.
Yeah.
We owe it to them.
Yeah. And I think it's funny you bring that up, because I think it's one of the things about, I guess, the diffuseness of the magical community is that we don't have that structure like Christianity, like around a church or anything. And so we have to build those ourselves kind of interpersonally. And those, yeah, I mean, it's really easy to go, I don't want to do that. That's, you know, when that's
right,
part
right.
of,
almost
that's
like
part of building a community. Right.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Whereas, yeah, you're right. That is such an important point about that. It's not like there's a manual apart from maybe something like Wicca or something like that, mm-hmm. right? There's just no manual, you know. When you look back through history, I mean, so many people, so many villages, so many cultures practice so differently. It is so blurry that it's almost like either I can't find sort of these pillars of how to practice, or there are none. So sky's the limit kind of thing. Mm-hmm. And there's no... And sometimes I think there's something freeing about that, but at the same time, it can be limiting, because we can sometimes use that to run away from our deepest fears. And one of them being, it is a good thing for all of us, therapist, witch, mystic, to contemplate what is going to happen to me.
I don't know. I mean, it's be prepared, right?
Yeah. Yeah. And in truth, in doing this work, Victoria, I it isn't easy. I sometimes sort of struggle. I'm turning 61. My kids are younger, right? Mm-hmm. So I had them later in life. There are things I want to do with them.
Right.
And there are things that life says, you may not. And that bothers me. Sometimes that scares me. So when I work with people on this thing, I don't want them to think I've got it together, because I don't. It is a tribal struggle, mm-hmm. and a tribal thing to work through. And no, there is no this, oh, I've accepted death. I hear that sometimes from people. I'm like, give me 10 minutes. I'll blow your little balloon just with a little hole. And you will see that this is very serious work. So it's mm-hmm. not easy, but we have enough defenses to run away from it, and we disguise them very well.
Yeah. I mean, I think there is, just with consciousness comes this existential fear of not existing. Right. That's just kind of part of being human and being self-aware. But
did you say Cuban?
Human, but maybe Cuban. Human. I mean, Cubans are part of that too. But yes, human. Yeah, I'm still unfortunately stuffed up. So,
No,
I do think about, like, you know, one of the things that I have found in magic and witchcraft that I didn't get the same when I practiced Christianity was the continuity of our souls in the same way, like either, you know, the idea of multi-part souls from different traditions or reincarnation, this connection with the ancestors. Like, I always felt within Christianity, like people die and they go to heaven and you don't get to talk to them anymore until you're in heaven. That's it. It's closed door.
Right. Right.
And in witchcraft, that's not really the case. It's like you are invited to have conversations with your ancestors and to think about that and what that means and to not necessarily choose your ancestors, but to also venerate people who might be outside of your family line in ways, you know, elders and teachers, and in my case, a lot of writers, you know, that I feel I have a connection to. I guess ancestors of ideas is the term. So
yes,
I think it's for me, like, it was easier to accept that I would get to join that throng coming from witchcraft than in Christianity for me. I don't think that's necessarily true for everybody, but that was kind of my experience.
That speaks to connection and in a powerful way. Now, there are people who might say, well, that's just your way of sort of dealing with the fear of existential non-existence kind of thing, right? Well, you know, all right, well, I've heard that argument for a long time, that I sort of create a heaven because I'm afraid of dying and just never existing again. Okay, that's plausible maybe to some degree. But then you hear people with near-death experiences, or you have people who have encounters with apparitions or spirits. All of these things are sort of nudging that there's more. And how naive of us to think that there's just, we're all, this is all that exists right here, right? Out of this huge thing. I mean, that's the same argument that's being dealt with now with non-human intelligence and UFO or UAP experience. And it's like,
the universe is really big.
Right? Right? it's almost like, why don't we want to believe that? Do we need to feel so great and mighty that we just don't want to give anything else space? Because in truth, this is a big place.
Okay, I have wondered, like, what happens with very centralized religion, you know, Abrahamic religions, when, you know, extraterrestrial life is proven, like we have it, you know, on the spot, like what happens, like what kind of crisis of faith does that cause?
I suspect it will create a lot in a lot of religion and science and in so many places and even in the craft. Because think about this, for example, we have thought for the longest time about reincarnation in a sense of ancestors and then us dying and coming back to this life and another body, all this stuff. But if there's non-human intelligence, and some of them, at least some of the reports from some experiencers are like, they get messages that we are your future. What we look like is what you will look like. Now, if you think of it in that sense, it's almost like, oh my God, that just takes reincarnation to another level that we haven't thought of for ages. However, I want to take that back because, I mean, if you look at some of the art, even in the context of religion, you will sometimes see artists having a sort of like this UFO light shining on Jesus's birth or on his baptism. It's fascinating stuff. These ideas have been going on for a while. So if there is more, I mean, it'll revolutionize so much, even religion. Like, did Jesus just die for this world? You know, it would throw Christianity upside down. And I think it would do something to our work as well, because it would introduce something that it would have to be a paradigm shift. We just cannot, we couldn't see it any other way.
Yeah. I don't know that I can even really think through what it would be, because it would, like you said, it would be so huge.
Big. Yeah.
That it's just hard to, But people are struggling with the fact that, you know, dolphins are way smarter than we think they are.
I know.
Yeah, I've always joked that if reincarnation is real, I want to come back as a dolphin on a planet that doesn't have fishing boats. That's my plan. But we'll see if I get that or not.
You hear about like reincarnation and stuff. And in my book, I put something that happened to me that was more like it was during a practice and it was more like a vision. And I'm very visual. So this came to me and I had a vision that I was walking down sort of like this stream of water with a little older of a friend. And it wasn't a very wonderful place. I saw trash and stuff. So I think poverty was a part of my life back then, if I understand this. But, you know, it's not like today, you know, whenever you talk about reincarnation, people want to go and they want to find the Cleopatra that they were, or King Tut, or all these great and mighties. And I remember somebody saying, man, many of these lives, it was boring. It was just another life. So when
you were
a surf,
you were a,
right. And so, and in that vision, I looked ahead and something gave me the feeling, this is where I was killed. I was killed there. And so out of that vision, and my little older friend, he felt so guilty that there was this sense of, you know, when you're on earth, I'll be there for you. When I'm on earth, you'll be there for me, kind of thing. It's almost this. So when I thought of that, I'm not one that looks for that kind of stuff. Like, I don't go around trying to find my past lives if I have any. When I had that, I said, okay, definitely it moves me. It can definitely explain some things of some of my personality today. But I said, but you know, I want to sort of understand as well the power of the unconscious. And so I don't know what that vision meant. It could be that it represented a past life. It could be something that my unconscious in its own complex ways put together.
Yeah.
But nevertheless, even when we have experiences and we're not sure, I think it's a good thing to examine it, but then at some point use it to grow. Like, I don't know about that vision, what it was, that real or not real, but I could take out of, sort of like we do with books, fiction books and movies, we can take out of stories to better our lives, you know?
Yeah. Oh, I feel like this is fodder for an entire new podcast. Like, we could talk about this forever.
Oh my gosh. We could, yes.
Yes, but I want to do our last question, and I want to make sure that we don't eat all of your day or the listener's day, but
Your day too.
Or my
your
day, yeah. Too. But so before we get to the last question, do you want to tell people where they can find you? This will air kind of early summer.
Okay.
There's an event or something you want to plug, but just you know, where people can find you and find your book.
You can go, I mean, you can find it on Amazon.com, right? Bring your pen, bring your broom. I do want to give my website, and I'll explain something about what's happening in the counseling field. My website is bodymindmetaphor.com, right? That gets, a lot of times people call it mind-body because we're used to calling things mind-body, but it's bodymindmetaphor.com. And then my, in there, I have different things about webinars and stuff that I do, but I do consultation and I do psychotherapy. And so a lot of consultation and education, I can sort of teach, you know, wherever I go. And if you're in one place, I'm in another, that's okay. Currently in the counseling field, there's a development taking place where the different states are beginning to open up and allow for some sort of counseling cross state lines. There's certain parameters you have to abide by and rules and ethics and all that stuff. And that's in the making. I don't know anything about it. But if that opens up, that's going to be cool because, you know, there are just people all over the place who I really want to reach out to and I really want to support and provide the therapy that they would like to get, but they're afraid. And it's hard to find. You know, we talked about hiding before. It's hard to find because even us as therapists who are connected to the practice, we sort of sometimes stay a little low, you know, for understandable reasons, you know. And so some of us don't advertise. Some of us don't say a whole lot, and it's hard for people to find us. But hopefully, if things work out that way, you know, my website will be a great starting point for. And I want to reach out to anyone in the craft who, you know, is struggling with things. I want to empower them. I want them to integrate who they are with what they practice. And I want them to feel what they can celebrate. So that would be the main point. But my book you could find on Amazon.com.
Awesome. Yeah. And I do recommend it, whether you are a therapist or not. Like, I think the audience is probably leaned more toward therapists, but I found it really enlightening in a lot of ways. So I would recommend.
And that's the funny thing about the book. It's like, it's sort of like spiritual care to elderly and dying loved ones. It's like both the professional, like the healthcare professional, mental health, and family members could both grab out of that. You know, and really, so it was like a dual sort of way. It's almost like my mind is split in two, you know. And so the same with the book, Bring Your Pen, Bring Your Broom. It has some really good info, even for people who want to know, how can I find a therapist who is sympathetic to the cause, sympathetic to my story? And at the same time, it is also for the therapist. So hopefully it could reach both audiences.
Awesome. Great. And all that'll be in the show notes for folks to have easy access to it. And so now we'll do our little game of chance, our little hook for the end here. So I'm going to roll this little purple die. And depending on what number I roll, you'll get a question about death, which we've talked about a lot, sex, religion, which we've also talked about, politics, or money. And if I roll a six, you get to pick which one you want.
Okay.
Let's see what we get to. Four. Politics. Haven't had this one for a while. So again, this might be a subject for a whole other podcast. But I've thought about this a lot in my own therapy and just in general. And reading your book, I thought about it with like how difficult it is to find a therapist, whether you're a witch or not, like to find someone you click with. But also like the how overtaxed the counseling and therapy profession is right now because so many people are seeking. But as I guess this is kind of as a therapist question, like I imagine, because I have felt this, but a lot of people who, you know, feel passionately about stuff, who have, you know, are paying attention out to the world, you know, they're what would be called depression or anxiety is situational in this huge context. So how do you approach that? Like, what is like, I guess, and it's hard to say an easy takeaway because I feel like this is, you know, we're not paying you for a therapy session, but how do you reconcile what is a human reaction to the world? It's not a broken reaction. It's the world that's broken.
Right. No, you know, I sort of shifted after I wrote this book. I sort of shifted from my view because we talk a lot about nature, nurture kind of thing. And what I have found is, you know, and I try to say these things respectfully because I'm not out to sort of target anybody or anything. But what I have found is that there is not convincing evidence that it is about us being broken. It is more about the world being broken that causes a lot of the things we struggle with, whether it's anxiety or depression. It's sort of like trauma, right? Trauma comes from without. And so, but it's a very scary thing, Victoria, because the entire system is so set up to where it's under the theory of a diseased model. That, you know, that if you have depression, it's because you have a chemical imbalance. Or if you have anxiety, it's because of something to do with, you know, it's, but there's no overwhelming, convincing evidence. And fortunately, you have people like psychiatrists and psychotherapists like that are coming out with this info because our field is in an empowering language. It's very disempowering And it and it, I mean, think about it. In 1952, we had like, what, 75 mental disorders. Now today in the DSM-5 TR or whatever it is, we have like almost 400. And I'm like, are we getting better or are we pathologizing this world? This mm-hmm. world needs changing. But if we're going to be pointing the finger that it's within you, that's in your brain, that's the problem, that's so disempowering. But it's a very big system. It involves a lot of money. It involves big pharma. It involves so many things that it's a very tough one to tackle. But what I do in my practice, I respect the rules and the regulations because I'm not out to try to create some revolution. But at the same time, I will defend the person as normal. Mm-hmm. And if there's concerns, I will address that. But I am not going to disempower them and send them the message that it is within them that's the problem.
Yeah. Yeah, I saw something the other day, which made me think to ask you this question is, I follow a lot of, you know, social justice accounts and stuff on social media, and someone had posted someone who had done graffiti somewhere that said, you don't need therapy, you need revolution. Uh-huh. And I was like, yeah, we, you know, we need basic human rights for a lot of people.
Right.
And that you don't need therapy, you need something to eat, you know, like it's, mm-hmm. this is the mm-hmm. issue. So I was like, yeah, now I've got you in the hot seat. I'll ask you about it.
Well, that's my biggest thing. And part of what led me to so much of this discovery is because I, again, in defense of whether it's the craft, whether it's defense of the experiencer, especially UFO, you know, people will quickly diagnose them with some pathology. People will quickly say it's psychosis or delusions. And I'm thinking, you know, what are we doing here? That is nothing but a quick flip of a blame. Mm-hmm. So I studied, what is psychosis? Let's talk about that. What is psychosis? What's the difference between psychosis and a divine or a experience of some sort? And so when I did that, I discovered it was some things that made me say, oh my God, you know, I've been working as a therapist this way. And there is not sufficient evidence for this kind of stuff. And so, you know, it took a little, it sort of step. I had to step back a little bit to discover, oh my God, what are we doing?
Yeah.
So
maybe you are causing a tiny revolution to start. Maybe you're the butterfly.
I feel much smaller than that, Victoria. I'm not sure if I'll be able to do. I have very little power when it comes to the powers that be.
Yeah. But I don't know. But you're speaking up. You're speaking up. Yeah. And that's huge. So
I appreciate that. I appreciate that support. Thank you.
Awesome. Well, thank you for your time and for being on the show and for sending me your lovely book. And I wish you all the best.
Thank you so much, Victoria. Thank you for connecting with me and the opportunity and the work that you do. I know that, you know, you're sort of in that room doing it by yourself kind of thing, and you do a lot of work to prep, but it's important for your voice to be out there.
Thank you. I appreciate that.
You're welcome. Thank you.
Witchlit is a production of Thousand Volt Press and is edited by Julian Rashke. Our intro music is Cosmic Glow by Andrew Kay, and our outro music is Voices by Alexander Shinekar. Transcripts and all our previous episodes are available at witchlitpod.com, and you can follow us on Instagram and Threads at witchlitpod. Please help other witches find us by leaving a rating or a view wherever you listen to podcasts. Thank you for listening to and reading Witchlit.